This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. You know, voting in California's recall election ends tomorrow. You probably do know that. And the candidates vying to replace Governor Gavin Newsom are making their final pitches. That includes South LA businessman and conservative talk radio host Larry Elder. He's the leading Republican challenger in the race, and he's been taking his pro-business and anti-Newsom message on the stump with him all across Los Angeles.
The way this man shut down this state means that one-third of all small businesses are now gone forever. Many of them owned by the Black and Brown and Asian American people that the left prides itself on caring about.
That's Elder talking about Newsom during a recent visit to the San Fernando Valley. He spoke at a family restaurant whose owners support the recall effort, and that support from small business is more common than you might think in reliably blue California. From restaurants to gyms, retail, and everything in between, many small businesses have been decimated during the pandemic. They watched big box retailers like Costco and Walmart and Target stay open when their shops had to close. And their plight has powered this recall effort. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb covers the business of Southern California, and he's with us right now with more. Hi, Benjamin.
Hey, Steve. Welcome back.
Thank you. Elder says one-third of small businesses are gone for good. Can we fact-check that? Is that true?
Well, the short answer is yes and no. It's really hard to measure the exact number of businesses that are shut down for good. It really depends on the metric you're using. But there is one we can look at. Here in Los Angeles, Yelp put together this report that found at the height of the pandemic, some 15,000 small businesses in LA shut down and about half of them closed down for good. His point about businesses owned by people of color, however, that is true. There's data to back it up. In fact, there's this investigation by the radio show podcast Reveal that looked into PPP money, and it found that Black and Brown businesses received substantially less federal help than white business owners during the pandemic.
Is Larry Elder, Benjamin, is he saying he's going to help businesses more? I mean, does he have a plan?
So he does, but listen to how he refers to the past, what Newsom has done, when I asked him about that very question a couple days ago.
What I would not have done is to shut down the businesses the way he did. I would not have had those kinds of mandates the way he did. I would have allowed people like Paul to operate with his own common sense and his own judgment.
So he went on, Steve, to talk about cutting taxes, reforming the workers' comp system, but his main talking point to business people is, look, I'm not Newsom. If we go back in time and if he were governor, he wouldn't have closed down the economy like Governor Newsom did. And that's really been his push to voters.
All right. So here we are now, 18, 20 months into the pandemic. The economy appears to be recovering. Gavin Newsom wanted the recall voting to happen sooner rather than later because people are bouncing back, correct?
Yeah, he did. That's true. I mean, look, unemployment keeps falling. The economy keeps growing. I mean, Steve, there are some sectors of the economy that are even doing better than they were before the pandemic. But some small businesses and their owners remain in deep, deep trouble. They're struggling to pay bills, struggling to pay payroll or find employees. And that includes Angela Marsden, for example. Now, Marsden runs the Pineapple Hill Saloon and Grill on Van Nuys Boulevard in Sherman Oaks.
I was behind $65,000 in rent in January, just rent. My payroll's $42,000 a month, okay? So now you have all these people that are going into September that are hundreds of thousands of dollars behind, and business has dropped 30%. We can't find staff. Our cost of goods are up, and you got to pay all this back rent because Newsom gave us nothing.
And you can hear that frustration, Steve, and you hear this a lot from small business owners really blaming Newsom for what's happened. Now, I want to be clear, not all small business owners support the recall, nor do all of them disapprove of Newsom or how he's handled the pandemic, but many do, especially those who have lost clientele, been forced to close. As for Marsden, I must point out she did get lucky. She had this outpouring of financial support online after a video she recorded went viral last year. You might remember it. In it, she walks into the parking lot behind her bar. She has this really elaborate outdoor patio setup. And it's empty because no one is allowed to eat at her restaurant at that time. This is last year again, last fall. And then her cell phone pans to an enormous outdoor patio space that's set up temporarily for dozens of people to eat outside in the same lot. This was for workers on an NBC comedy shoot. And that's because, at that time, the film industry wasn't under the same restrictions.
I'm losing everything. Everything I own is being taken away from me. And they set up a movie company right next to my outdoor patio, which is right over here.
Now, when I spoke with Marsden, she told me that her experience in her mind exemplifies how she thinks the health restrictions have been arbitrary. Many small business owners simply blame Newsom for all of this. They say his policies are responsible, and he's really their scapegoat. That includes Alan Brodetsky. His family owns and operates the Valley Inn restaurant and martini bar on Ventura Boulevard. It's a local spot. It's been there since the 1940s. And the restaurant recently played host to a Larry Elder event. And that's where Brodetsky talked about the ripple effect COVID-19 has had on people visiting his family's restaurant.
Many of the high-rise office buildings that you see around you remain partially empty. Our family restaurant used to have a thriving lunch shift serving the community. We are now closed completely for lunch. Gavin Newsom is responsible for residents and businesses fleeing our state.
So Brodetsky would go on to say that some of his family's regular customers have even left California during the pandemic, where there are less COVID restrictions. Of course, this is just his opinion about why people are leaving California. There's lots of factors, and it's been talked about a lot here on our show. But again, that's his perspective on this, Steve.
So basically, Benjamin, these small business owners that you identify, they say that it's Newsom's fault because of his protocol during the pandemic and shutting, you know, many of the businesses down, or at least limiting what they can do. A lot of them also think that he's a hypocrite as well, right?
Oh, yeah. And this is something I've heard not just reporting on this story, but reporting the past year on the pandemic and its effects on business owners. Newsom's hypocrisy, or his perceived hypocrisy, is a big issue. For example, sending his kids to private school when public schools were closed. And of course, that now infamous French laundry meal in November when he dined indoors at a time when those types of gatherings were not allowed in other parts of California.
And these issues go back last year, when society was really shut down. Have business owners been pushing the recall through from the beginning? I mean, have they jumped on the bandwagon from the start?
Yeah, I think you can say that. In fact, many businesses actually served as signature gathering sites for the recall. That includes a spot called Auto Books Aero Books on Magnolia Boulevard in Burbank. Tina Van Curen has run this place. It's a used bookstore since 2007. And she says she used to get visitors from all over the world. It's this kitschy, kind of one-of-a-kind store. But that's changed, she says, with the travel restrictions that are in place and other restrictions, too. Van Curen also told me she wasn't really ever super into politics. She was engaged, but never really active until this recall effort, when she found a lot of like-minded people that were registering online to serve as signature gathering sites.
It's a grassroots movement from people like me and people who used to have a job in a store, people who used to work in a gym, or people who used to have a business, who think that this is, that our state is completely mismanaged, and they want to do something about it. They want to see change. They'd like people who've lived here for a long time, like me. I was born here. My parents, my grandparents were in L.A. as small children in the 1880s. But, you know, we're thinking, we can't retire in California. Nobody can afford to retire in California. Most people can't afford to live in California.
You hear there this gloomy perspective, this gloomy forecast for California and its future. That's also very common amongst supporters of the recall. You heard her mention homelessness, crime, cost of living. Van Curen says she hopes the recall will change some of that. However, let's point out, even if Newsom is recalled and replaced, the candidate who wins only gets a year in office before they must run again. Van Curen is aware of this and says she's primed for this year-long experiment, and others are too.
So these business owners, Benjamin, are hungry for change, but how do the numbers play out? I mean, if you look at voter registration, for example, Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. Here in the Golden State, the polls do look good, at least right now they do, for Newsom.
They look very good. I mean, if you look at any of the major polls in the last month, Newsom sits atop those, many by double digits. So that being said, Steve, this is not a presidential election year. It's not even November, right? So turnout is expected to be low, and that normally skews voting toward Republican candidates. Right now, Elder is leading the pack of those Republican candidates with about 25% in the polling, and that tracks with the business owners that I've met. They're supporting him.
All right. Tomorrow is the last day to vote, obviously, in the recall. We'll have more details on the election and the implications. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb, who covers business in Southern California. Benjamin, thanks.
Anytime, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Police officers spend a lot of time interviewing people at the scene of a crime or maybe a car accident. They get your name, your phone number to follow up, maybe some identifying information like your height, your eye color. Officers with the LA Police Department also ask for your Instagram handle. Documents obtained by the Brennan Center for Justice show that LA cops are instructed to collect social media data on every civilian they stop, regardless of if you're arrested or even accused of a crime. And that's raising big concerns about civil liberties and mass surveillance. Sam Levin is a reporter at The Guardian, where he covers the LAPD. Hey, Sam.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so officers, this is such an interesting story. Officers collect information on what are called field interview cards, and you actually have a picture of one of these cards in your web story. What did the Brennan Center find out was on those cards?
So the Brennan Center found out that there was a section on the field interview cards in which officers ask for social media information, such as Instagram handle, Facebook, Twitter, etc. The Brennan Center also did a search of police departments across the country and was unable to find a single other police department that had this requirement on these cards, which are pretty, you know, standard practice used in everyday policing. And so the finding of social media information on those cards has raised significant civil liberties questions and just basic questions about why the LAPD is routinely collecting this information in the first place.
Do you have to answer that question? I mean, is it one of those things where if you don't, they can arrest you?
So there's not specific law about whether you have to provide your social media information to police. But like in many instances and interactions with police, obviously you have a right to remain silent. And, you know, if you're not under arrest or being detained, you know, you have a right to ask the officer if you can leave and to not give information. And so you always have that right to remain silent. Of course, it depends on the specific circumstances, you know, why you're interacting with police in the first place. But there's no specific law requiring you to give your social media information to police.
I mentioned the Brennan Center. Why was it requesting this information from LAPD in the first place? I mean, was there a suspicion that they were collecting and tracking social media accounts?
So the Brennan Center has done a lot of work scrutinizing police departments over social media monitoring and just surveillance more broadly. And so they had done a sort of broad request for information related to LAPD and how it was monitoring people's social media. So they weren't specifically looking for this issue with field interview cards, but that came up through the records request and was one of the more sort of shocking findings from the many emails and internal records they obtained.
There's also a line that I saw for a person's social security number, which got me thinking, you know, don't sanctuary laws prevent police officers from asking civilians their immigration status? Someone who is not here legally doesn't have a social security number, right?
Yeah, so that was just another finding that the Brennan Center kind of stumbled on, and they saw that these cards request social security information, which, as you say, appears to violate the spirit of the sanctuary laws at the very least, you know, which say that police specifically are not supposed to ask people about their immigration status. And in many ways, asking for a social security number can be a proxy for immigration status since, you know, there are undocumented folks who don't have social security numbers. And so that raised huge alarms for civil rights leaders here in LA, when we reported on that, because, you know, LA specifically has taken a number of steps to have strong sanctuary laws, and even LAPD has taken steps in the past that are meant to reduce the perception that they might be collaborating with immigration enforcement. And so this inclusion here on the card would seem to suggest the opposite. And what was more troubling was that it also included a bizarre disclaimer on the card that officers were supposed to read, suggesting that people are required to provide their social security number under federal law. And experts I talked to said that that does not appear to be true. There is no law that says, you know, state or local police can ask you for your social security number and you have to provide it.
You interview, Sam, several activist groups in your piece, including Black Lives Matter LA, the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, as well as law and justice experts. I mean, what's been the reaction to what you guys have found and what the Brennan Center has found?
So activists have always suspected that police were monitoring their social media activity. And you know, there's tons of records to suggest that LAPD has closely monitored Black Lives Matter and other, you know, civil rights groups that, you know, protest police brutality. I think many of them were surprised and disturbed to learn that there appeared to be this sort of widespread collection of social media data from just everyday interactions with police. And that seemed to be a kind of potential surveillance that was on a scale that, you know, these activists had not imagined.
The LAPD came out with a response last week saying that people communicate through social media now just as much as they do through, you know, their phones or texts or emails. So are they saying, Sam, that they collect social media information as another way to get in touch with that person, that it's not a way to monitor them?
So that has been their public response to our reporting, essentially saying that this is just another form of how we get in touch with people, just like a phone number, et cetera. However, we've seen from the internal messages that they've been, you know, communicating on the field interview cards and specific to social media, that there's been a different message. You know, we've seen, you know, a couple years ago, the previous police chief, you know, said that the police department was adding social media because this can be important, you know, information now and is a marker of someone's identity. And we saw, you know, more recently, the current police chief last year, not specific to the social media, but reminded all staff that they must fill out all the information on the card as thoroughly and fully as possible, specifically because it's useful in arrests and prosecution and investigations. And so there are many reasons to believe that, you know, this is not just being used as a way to get in touch with folks, but that, you know, this could be used for future investigations and for, you know, potential arrests and prosecution.
Also curious is the fact that they told you that the field interview card policy was being updated. Those were their words, but they didn't tell you what the details of that update would be. I mean, have you heard anything more about what they mean by that, updated?
Yes. So I have asked them repeatedly for follow-up information on that, and they have confirmed to me that the policy is still being updated and have provided no additional detail of how it is being updated. And, you know, we've been asking the LAPD about this policy for, you know, a few weeks now since I first started reporting on this and reviewing the documents that Brennan Center obtained. And so it's unclear what the changes might be, but I'm certainly keeping an eye on it and plan to report on it when there's an update.
Yeah, we're keeping an eye on it as well. Sam Levin, who covers the LA Police Department for the Guardian newspaper. Sam, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Moving on now with Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiotakis. The number of people experiencing homelessness continues to rise and has risen during the pandemic all across the state. And that includes Orange County. Gloria Cease has been helping to feed and care for the homeless in OC for more than 25 years from her nonprofit called Mary's Kitchen. But according to local officials, Cease has until this Saturday to vacate the lot that she's been using for more than a quarter century, 26 years. Some say her nonprofit has contributed to crime in the neighborhood and is out of step with how to best help people experiencing homelessness. Here to talk about it, and fresh from an article about it, Gustavo Arellano is a columnist at the LA Times with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Now, Mary's Kitchen has been operating from this lot, as I mentioned, for 26 years. Why are officials saying it needs to be vacated now?
That is a grand mystery, because here's a nonprofit with roots back in the 1980s, started by an 82-year-old former nurse back then called Mary McAnena, and everyone loved it. Donations came in. They were doing really great work. And as recently as 2019, the city of Orange, in approving a 5-year lease for them, said, hey, you know, despite how much work they do, how busy they are, this place is immaculate. That was in the staff report. Then all of a sudden, at the beginning of this year, they go to Gloria and say, hey, by the way, we're getting a lot of crime in the area around Mary's kitchen. So you're going to have to do A, B, C, and D. And you're also going to need other bigger nonprofits to come in and help you out. And Gloria's like, no, we've been perfectly fine. And Gloria, by the way, is 82 years old now. We've been doing this fine for decades. I don't need the help. So the city in July, they give them a eviction notice. You have 90 days to leave. And it's this Saturday is the last day.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, feeding people who don't have the wherewithal to feed themselves is a good thing. I wonder, I mean, is the specific criticism, Gustavo, the fact that crime is up just around the area where she is?
That was the ostensible reason. And then in the past couple of months, as obviously there's been an uproar, everyone from State Senator Sharon Quirk Silva has asked the city what the hell's going on. Everyone from even the Bishop of Orange, Kevin Van, called Councilwoman Ariana Barrios, who I interviewed, and said, like, hey, like, this is what's going on. But the other, now the city's saying that Mary's Kitchen does not fit into what they call, their words, you want to talk about a bureaucrat ease, the continuum of care that they envision Orange when it comes to homeless folks. And this is the problem in their eyes with Mary's Kitchen. All they are is a soup kitchen. And not only that, they'll allow anyone. Most of homeless services in Orange County, especially, you need a referral, you need an ID. It makes it really hard. Mary's one of the last places where they'll accept anyone and they will not ask any questions. I mean, you do have to, can't be a jerk, you can't be aggressive or anything like that. Yes, but other than that, if you want a free meal, come on in.
You visited the kitchen and you've seen exactly what she's doing over there. I mean, what did you see?
Oh, I saw a soup kitchen where you had these volunteers just giving their entire heart out. And here's Gloria, 82 years old, running around. My favorite moment was she goes into the kitchen where she's overseeing middle-aged men and women, like, cutting up the cheese for the roast beef sandwiches for lunch. She goes in just to check in, and then she's looking around like, oh, I found this crate of blueberry muffins, and the crate says soap. And then she goes out and starts handing it out to people. This is a woman who just completely, not overwhelmed the way some people are making her out to be. I saw nothing but order there. I saw 200 people lining up, wearing masks, by the way, and if you didn't have a mask, Mary's Kitchen would provide those masks. There was one incident where a man was told to leave because he was yelling at people. But other than that, everyone, like, it was amazing. I was expecting, for crying out loud, Councilwoman Barrios described the alleged crimes going on in front of Mary's Kitchen in the past as Dante's Inferno. This was not Dante's Inferno. This is more like that scene in The Grapes of Wrath, the film, where the Jodes go into this government camp and everything's pretty good.
So when Orange County says, you know, it doesn't really match up with the continuum of care, what do they mean by that? I mean, do they say that they have a better way to feed the people, the homeless folks of Orange County?
They don't say anything. I mean, what they're saying now, again, remember, this is a nonprofit that's been going on for 40 years. Now, all of a sudden, they have found gospel in this continuum of care. Their specific critique of Mary's Kitchen is that they don't do anything to end homelessness, that all they do is feed people. And Gloria's response was like, yeah, this continuum of care thing, we just call it taking care of people. And not only that, Mary's Kitchen does try to help homeless folks, try to get in contact with other services that might be able to get them a job, that might be able to get them housing or whatnot. But they're focused just specifically on that. And I'm sorry, when it comes to being unhoused, one of the very first things that's going to be gnawing at you literally is your hunger, because you don't have a place to eat.
Well, as we mentioned, you know, she has until this Saturday. What's Mary's Kitchen's options at this point?
She's exploring legal options, wouldn't say anything, of course. But she said one way or another, Mary's Kitchen's going to continue, because just because the city of Orange does not want them to operate there doesn't mean that somehow all these people are going to have free breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or hunger's going to be ending. So she still has work today, one way or another. If the city wants to work with her, well, you know, fine. And if not, well, their loss and, you know, Gloria Cease will continue.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist over the LA Times, and of course with KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Well, that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, along the Central Coast, a group of Chumash built a nursery to preserve and cultivate native seeds for culturally relevant food and medicine and fiber. We're going to take you there tomorrow. In the meantime, a reminder of all the places that we've already taken you and the places we're going to go. It's KCRW's good old-fashioned pledge drive, and here's how it goes. You give, and KCRW plays on. It's as simple as that. You know that KCRW has you covered, whether that's a big news story. Oh, yeah, there's a recall election tomorrow that wraps up. Or maybe you're seeking an escape through music and storytelling. We've got you covered. Member support is our largest source of funding. We hope you'll have us covered by going to kcrw.com/give. Thank you for your support. If you're already a member, we do thank you. Now it's time to pass it on. Tell your friends. Maybe add a little bit to the Tilly. KCRW.com/join or 800-600-KCRW. It's an easy way to keep this radio station strong and healthy. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Rebecca Mooney, Sonia Geist, John Meek, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Todd, Christine Comito, and Holly Adams all had hands and ears on the show. I'm Steve Chiatake. It's nice to be back. Thanks for your ears and time tonight. Have yourself a great night.